You're listening to WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM and streaming live at WMRW.org and also going on MRVTV in the Mad River Valley. And we are speaking to Terry Nelson, who was a border customs official, also with the Air Marines, and also a member of Homeland Security. Thank you very much for coming on today, Terry. Greatly appreciated. And so I'm just wondering to start off, where did you grow up and what made you decide to go into law enforcement?
Well, I grew up on a ranch down in South Texas. My dad was a foreman. And at $5 a day working in the hot sun all day, I knew that wasn't going to cut it. So, no, I wanted to be a cop from a very early age, but I was too tall to get into state police at the time, so I went into federal service, which was probably a wise choice, looking back at it. After I grew up, and then I went off to Vietnam, which is what everybody did in the 60s, and came back from that. I worked for the railroad for a while until I got hired by the Border Patrol, and from then on, I was in federal service for 32 years, including 3 years, three tours in Iraq as a police advisor to the Iraqi Department of Border Enforcement.
So then... How did you get involved with LEAP? What was the pivotal point?
Well, as a national level commander in Department of Homeland Security at the time, it was called Customs Air and Marine Operations. I saw the futility of the efforts. I had been involved in it for many years, working in Mexico. I worked in every country in Central America except Nicaragua, and then five countries in South America. And it was obvious that what we were doing wasn't working. We weren't going to win the, quote, war on drugs the way we were fighting it. So I had on occasion brought up the issue that we needed to change our strategy. And about a year before I retired, I was at a meeting of the USIC conference, which is United States Interdiction Committee conference, and I said my viewpoint. I said, look, we're not winning. Why don't we change how we're doing this? And I got strong rounding of applause from the other room, but not from the Washington, D.C. guy that was in the front of the room. So he called me up and stuck a finger in my chest and told me, Agent Nelson, you don't make policy, you carry it out. And, of course, I saluted smartly and sat down. I thought, well, you arrogant son of a gun, you know. You won't even listen to your field commander when they're telling you this isn't working. So then I retired. Well, I'll back up just a second. In January of 2005, I went to Ecuador in South America with my team, 25 men, two airplanes, and we busted 14 metric tons of cocaine, which is about 30,000 pounds. 6 months later, when I retired in June of 2005, the price of cocaine had not changed on the streets of America. So if you can take 30,000 pounds out of the distribution network and not change the price, of course, it's all supply and demand, then you're not going to do any good busting a gram in an alley or ruining some kid's life because he's got a little powder on him or a rock or crack on him. It's just not going to happen. So
right.
We need to change the way we're fighting the war. And then I ran into a group called LEAP, which is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and I liked the guys I met. They were not, just the old saying, long-haired, pill-popping, pot-smoking hippie freaks. They were serious police officers that were trying to change a bad policy,
right.
And I threw my hat in the ring with them, and I've been with them ever since.
So could you tell me what is the U.S. policy when they're fighting the drug war? What do they tell you how to run operations, et cetera, et cetera? Like,
operations and intelligence officer. So basically, I either help plan or plan the operations themselves. No, I was given the goal was to stop illegal contraband from entering the United States. It's a pretty simple goal. We did everything we could to try it, and it didn't work because supply and demand and our borders are very porous, and I don't want to live in a society that's a police state. And quite frankly, even when Russia was a police state, they couldn't keep drugs out. So it's not something you can do through enforcement. It's something you're going to have to do through education and information, credible information, education, and people that fall through the cracks and become addicted. And we're just going to have to give them medical treatment to cure them instead of putting them in jail, because that obviously doesn't cure an ailment. It just exacerbates it.
Could you give me an example? So if you were going to, say, go to Colombia or something, and there was a drug cartel or something that you were told was a problem and they wanted you to deal with. Is it possible for you to say step by step what you would do, like infiltrate and then see what the
flow is? That wasn't what I did. I handled the air routes coming out, the smuggling routes. We would pick up targets coming off the ground in Colombia that were coming out of the known cocaine areas, or were there very little police presence, and at the time it was run by the FARC or other smuggling groups. And we would pick the airplanes up coming off the ground, and then we would get on them and identify them, and we'd follow them to their destination. When they'd make their drops, we would then coordinate the people on the ground to come in and try to arrest them. And a lot of times they would drop in Central America, and the police forces there were just as corrupt as the people smuggling the dope. And we would vector the people into the ground where the thing had happened, and nothing would ever happen. The dope would get away, so to speak. Otherwise, it would be sold by a different party. So it was obvious we weren't going to win. So if you're not going to win something, you don't keep spending. We spend about $80 billion a year on the drug war, and if you're not winning, you don't keep doing it. 40 years or four decades of a losing policy, a policy that doesn't work, we will call it a failed public policy,
right?
Then you need to change your strategy. You need to come up with a different way of dealing with these problems. And drugs do cause problems, but not as many problems as the drug war has caused.
Right. So then what strategy changes would you suggest as far as dealing with the enforcement?
Well, I think total legalization of all drugs and a strong implementation of a regulation and control system to take the drugs out of the hands of the cartels and the drug and street gangs, to put them in a regulated environment where they are taxed or entered into commerce legally, so you have some control over them, and then you can set age limits on who can buy the drugs, you can set amounts that they can buy. All of that would be regulation and control, but you must take it out of the hands of the cartels or people that are the violent gangs, that people that are killing other people so they can sell on that street corner. The legalization of drugs will probably cure about 80% of our crime and violence in our country. And little belongs to most people. Crime is down in this country. The current crime and the killings in Detroit and Chicago and New Orleans and Washington, D.C. are mostly drug-related killings, or a large percentage of them are. So I saw some news day before yesterday that the United States ranked fourth in the world as for murders. But if you take away four cities, the four that I just mentioned,
right,
we're fourth from the bottom in murders. So, and those cities are racked by drug violence. It's common sense. That's how you fix a problem. You put the product in a regulated environment. Take it out of the hands of an unregulated environment.
Yeah, well, that's like here in Vermont. They just decriminalized marijuana, So you've decriminalized it, but in the same time, it's still an illegal buying pattern. You know, you haven't changed anything with the criminal activity.
And that's the problem with decriminalization, and why you must have legalization, because decriminalizing it just makes the possession of illegal, but the people doing the distribution are still illegal, and therefore the huge profits are still there and the corruption that comes along with it.
So did you see corruption firsthand? Could you give examples of what you might have seen happening?
Well, yeah. When I worked in the Florida Keys, the director of the entire region was working for the bad guys and went to prison. The director of the station just to the north of me was working for the bad guys and got life in prison. And one of the people I worked with was fired and sentenced to 2 years in prison, or 18 months, for, I don't call it a bad act. He falsified a search warrant, but he knew the dope was in the house. We'd already seen it. There was about 10,000 pounds of weed. But he didn't follow the rules, and he was fired, and eventually went to prison. And that's when I resigned from the service at that time, from what I was doing in the Keys. I quit being a Marine boat operator and investigator, and went to over to inspection. The corruption was just too bad, and people would plant dope on boats so they could seize them, and I couldn't go that route, because then you must keep the moral high ground when you're dealing with crime, and when you become a criminal to enforce the law, you no longer have the moral high ground.
Yeah, that's what I mean, that's what I see with the war on terror, the same thing. I mean, it seems like they're helping people get bombs and stuff like that. It's like you're making it happen opposed to actually going after bad guys. You're just doing it for almost press, and that's the way I see the drug war in a lot of cases. So do you feel like a lot of these people were just in it for the money, or maybe they were blackmailed or something like that that made them go corrupt? Or
when you have according to DEA estimates, about 900,000 teenagers selling drugs, and teenagers mostly sell to other teenagers, not necessarily to adults, which means they're selling on the high school grounds or sometimes the middle school grounds, or they're selling in their friends of school friends, which are all juveniles and under the legal age that I would have for consumption. When you have that, you have one guy here making lots of money, and you got another guy working at Burger King or Whataburger or someplace flipping burgers for minimum wage. And at the end of the day, one guy brings home a paycheck for $250, and the other guy has $250 in his pocket any day you run into him. So they see it. They see, this guy's got a better deal than me. And even if he gets caught, he's not going to get spanked too hard the first time, so I'm going to do this. I can make a lot more money. But what they don't realize is it's not just the arrest that gets you. It's the criminal record that follows you the rest of your life. So then you're going to have to cook burgers the rest of your life or do minimum wage labor, because you're not going to be able to get hired if you have to check the box that says you have a criminal record.
Right. So could you say what was one of the biggest missions that you did as far as bringing in the most drugs, or one of the most complicated operations that you ever did?
Well, the biggest one, of course, was the 14 metric tons of coke.
Mm-hmm.
But that was planned by someone else. The best one I had was 1,350 pounds of coke, which I did the initial investigation, set up a pattern where this guy was making the drops. He did it often enough that over a period of about 2 years, I was able to develop a pattern. I figured out when he was probably most likely to do it, percentage-wise. And then I asked for permission to work the case, and the boss was, we didn't work the day he was doing it. We didn't have enough people to work 7 days a week. And I asked the boss if I could work it on overtime, if he'd give me an airplane and a crew, and he says, yeah. So I got an airplane and a crew, and we worked it for 3 weeks. The third week, we caught the guy coming in, 1,350 pounds of cocaine, and we busted him. We got the guys on the ground and eventually managed to get about 20 more arrests out of it. This was in Puerto Rico, and then the informant that we had was assassinated. So going back to square one, and even though we took down that large group, the amount of smuggling coming into Puerto Rico never changed. We were having about 5,000 pounds a week hitting the shores, and we would occasionally catch 1,000 pounds or 800 pounds or 500 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we weren't getting a very small fraction. And of course, once it gets to Puerto Rico, it's the same as being in the United States, because it's not checked again when the cargo leaves are coming in the United States. It's not checked again. That's why they wanted to use it, of course.
Huh, interesting. So then when you first started drug enforcement, what made you go into drug enforcement? And then what was your ideals of how you were going to change the world, in a sense, by going into this?
I never was so the illusion that I thought I was ever going to change the world. I was just doing the job because it paid well. I made a good living. It was lots of fun to do.
Okay.
I started out in the Border Patrol, and I went over in 1983 I was taught in the academy in 81 and 82, and in 1983 I went over to work for Customs down in the Keys. At those days, Miami Vice was on TV, Don Johnson and Tubbs were the heroes of the day, and
right.
And I actually ran a boat just like theirs. And one time they were filming some scenes down in Key West, and they parked their boat right beside ours, and they wanted to go have some drinks with us, and we wouldn't do it. We said, "No, we're the real guys. You're the pretend guys. We're not going to do that." So we didn't go out with them. They were a little bit miffed about that, but we thought we were a big hot tuna because we turned them down.
Nice. So then, while working on Border Patrol, were there many drugs coming across the border then, or were you mainly dealing with immigration issues?
Well, of course. I mean, that's how it comes in. It comes
right
across the border. Primarily immigration issues, but in the course of your duties, you're monitoring the border. You're watching for people that are coming off or smuggling loads that are coming in, or if you're working anti-smuggling, you see these things. And, And since it's crime, it's often intertwined. I mean, sometimes they will have the backpackers, the illegal guys that want to come in will have to bring in X amount of drugs with them, and then they'll drop them off, and then they'll go on and complete their smuggling route, go to wherever they're going, Chicago or, you know, New York or wherever they're going to go to work. And they carry the drugs in as part of their pay. That's one thing, mm-hmm. that you run into it that way. Another thing, you're just watching, and you see something developing. And it turns out instead of a smuggling load, it's a smuggling load of narcotics. And it's being entered into country into the revenue of the country illegally, so therefore it's a felony, and you make the arrest for it. We did not have arrest authority. We didn't have Title 21 arrest authority for drugs. We did all of our arrests under Title 18 United States Code, which is entry of goods into the United States.
Interesting. Huh. So is there any other points that you would like to bring up that you've been thinking about that people should know?
No, I just some of the positive things that have happened with the states that have been doing what they've been doing. We actually saw a decrease of about 100,000 people being arrested last year. So that's 100,000 of our citizens that don't have arrest records this year and can still go out and get jobs. That's positive. I think we will see the same or maybe a higher number this year, maybe as much as 200,000 less than 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
These are all very positive things, and they're brought about by the states like Vermont changing the law somewhat, not arresting people for small amounts of possession, giving people a chance to grow up and go on and become productive citizens. And to me, that's success. I would like to see total abolition of prohibition, and I think we will. But I think we're a couple of years away from that finally happening.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this is relevant or not, but so when you were in Iraq, did you discuss any drug policy over there, or what is Iraq's drug policy, or that didn't even come into play?
Well, on paper, they have a very serious drug policy. It's a very heavy prison sentence if you have drugs. However, the places I work, raw opium was often brought in and small amounts in people's pockets. They, over there, they use it as medicine. Mm-hmm. A person, say, with stomach cancer would have a chunk of raw opium in their pocket that they nibble on during the day to kill the pain. We didn't do anything. The Iraqi government would look at us and would say, I don't have a problem with it. And they would just turn to people. They would confiscate the drugs and send the people back to Iran. And that was the end of it, because they saw it as what it was. This is a sick person that needs this for medicine, or if not, this is an addicted person, not a criminal. They weren't bringing in a huge amount, although by American standards, a chunk of about an ounce or 2 ounces would be huge standards. But
right.
In that part of the country, it really isn't, because raw opium is everywhere, and especially in southern Iran and, of course, throughout Afghanistan, needless to say.
Right, so for most part, it's basically a medicinal thing, so their drug policy, they don't really need to worry about it, in essence.
Well,
they
give face value to it because the United States wants them to, but in reality, they understand that this person isn't a criminal.
Right.
He's making a really bad choice, but and I'm sure there are some people that I didn't work with that would want to chop your head off for doing it, but the people I work with are much more rational than that.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Huh. Okay. Well, shoot, I guess that's about it. You pretty much covered it all. It sounds like you've had an interesting life, definitely.
I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Nice. It seems like you made some good choices there. Huh. All right. Well, thank you very much for doing the job that you've done, and the things that you're saying definitely make sense to me, and it was a pleasure to be able to talk to you.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity to put Leap's message out on your radio, and I commend you for the work that you're doing at the radio station, and have a safe day.
All right, and you do the same. Thank you very much, Terry.
Yeah, ciao.
Yep, ciao. Okay, there you go. And it's always sort of funny that it's always, I have a lot of these guests on, and it always seems to be pretty similar in what they say, and then the whole thing with the drug war and the jobs that people do, it tends to be specialized, so they're not in the whole big thing. They're doing one part. Like when we had DE agents on before, same thing. They're doing one part. And they tend not to talk too much about details, but then again, how many details, I guess, are there? You're going after bad guys. This is the person reported. This is how we're going to get them. We're going to follow them, bring their plane down, confiscate the drugs, et cetera, et cetera. And so it just seems to be sort of the same thing. You know, it's a simple process. You know, we tend to think it's more complicated than it actually is. It's just a problem when money comes into play as far as corruption with officers and then also just departments wanting money to get the resources, you know, be it office supplies, guns, you know, equipment, you know, and it seems to be that people get caught on getting the money, not necessarily that they even agree with enforcing the drug policies, but it's more about getting the money and the funding so people get paid and make a good living. You know, so it's ongoing and very interesting. Because as I do these interviews, I start to see the pattern, and eventually people get disillusioned by what's going on. And you're working with it day in and day out, and you're the ones on the front line, and you're seeing that this isn't doing anything. Because, I mean, you can bust somebody, you can take the drugs off the street, but someone else is going to step up thinking they're going to be the one to make the money, live the high life, be the gangsta, so to speak. You know, and someone's always going to come into play. You know, and then you can go, well, if you legalize it, then businesses and corporations are going to take it over and yada, 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 which, yes, that is a possibility. But then again, as with Prohibition, I mean, when Prohibition of alcohol was going on, alcoholism was much higher than it is today. I mean, it dropped after it became legal, you know, and it basically what happens, and I would figure the same with the drugs, you know, first gets legalized, people are going to go party till you drop, you know, and you're going to have some people fall to the wayside, but that happens already. But if you have regulated heroin, and I know a lot of people go, oh my God, regulated cocaine, basically the cuts that go into it, which also make it profitable when you just put this other filler stuff in, you know, makes it more profitable for legal gain, you know, and makes it much more unsafe for the users, which then when they have to go to hospitals and they can't afford to deal with the expenses, then basically the public picks up that expense. So that is another expense of the drug war, which a lot of people don't think about. You know, so if you regulate it, you're going to make your dose, it's going to be consistent. You know, maybe they'll have different grades, I don't know what it would be, but you're going to know what it's cut with. You're going to know the strength. So, like, one day you're shooting up your heroin, and then, oh, it was weak. So you're like, oh, okay, I'm going to have to double up, you know. But then you got another dose from Joey or whatever, and it was more pure, and then it ends up killing you, you know. There are people that are always going to do it. And I liked when he was talking about Iraq with the opium. You know, opium was used medicinally in this country a lot, and still is. You know, it's like when we have now the right to terminate life in the state or assisted suicides. But doctors have been doing that for years with morphine. Overdose them on morphine, the people go to sleep. It's something that's not talked about, but it's something that's very real and has been going on for a long time. And I've seen it done firsthand. So, you know, we tend to make big deals out of things and want to save life and, oh, we got to fight the drug war for our children's sake, when you're actually making it worse for your children by doing this, because you just support the crime. That's how crime works. You got to have good guys and bad guys. Eliminate the bad guys, you can go on and do other things. But anyway, on that note, we gotta say, where are we going? Somewhere, I'm sure. But anyway, forward ho. You're listening to WMRW LP Warren 95.1 FM, streaming live at WMRW.org.